Thank you, Keenan. All right, Chaos Theory's in the books. It's only an hour. It's Jeff. It's Jordan. Yeah, so I'm going to be on for more than an hour today because I'll be on for the normal show, and then I'm doing the midday program with BK today. So I'll be on until 1 o'clock today. Jordan will be heading out a little bit afternoon. Yeah, pickleball, that's the one sport we could play where I feel like I could at least, from a physical standpoint, hang in there for a minute from a stamina standpoint. Like, if we played, like, pickup basketball, dude, I haven't played pickup basketball in years. Like, I wouldn't be able to do that. If you want to have, like, a horse competition, I'd be down for that. But, it's an Olympic year, so we might have to have the Texas Sports Unfiltered Olympics. BK, if you're listening, this could be a sponsorship opportunity. But I digress. Jordan, how was your weekend, man?
Not too bad at all. Sorry.
Bat phone ringing
just,
or what?
Just had to. Yeah. We're getting to the portals opening tomorrow, so not excited, but I'll be waking up about 5-6 in the morning tomorrow and for the next 2 weeks, pretty much, just because that's what you got to do.
It's weird because the primary activity we're monitoring for Texas is not necessarily who's coming in, because I think we've got a pretty good idea that it's defensive line or bust. I mean, I don't, knock on wood and crossing my fingers and all that stuff, as long as there's not like an injury in the spring game or this week in spring practice, Jordan, you correct me if I'm wrong, I don't see any outside of interior defensive line, I don't see any holes on this roster. There are some spots that are still to be determined, maybe some spots in the two deep that are still to be determined, but there's not a spot where I look like, man, they need this. It's really interior defensive line help. That's really where it's at.
Yeah. Like you said, I agree. I think, interior defensive line is for sure the main need. I think anyone can see that. But while that might or could be the only position that Texas at this point in time is like, yeah, we need that. Sarka and the rest of the staff, they're a bunch of smart guys. If someone pops in the portal that they view as an upgrade over what they currently have, and it's not going to take a ridiculous amount of dollars to go get them,
mm-hmm.
Texas is going to show interest. And
yeah,
one thing I've had a lot of talks with my buddies last week is, like, with the SEC interconference rule still being a thing this spring where SEC players can't transfer to other SEC schools, I have a feeling we're going to see a select group of players be severely overpaid. For example, Ochuan Mathis. That was like the guy in the portal that spring. Mm-hmm. And Nebraska, they overpaid for him. I don't know what the number was, but I can tell you right now, whatever they paid him, the play they got back from him for 1 year was 1,000% not worth it.
It was a lot.
Yeah, and I know Texas had a lot for him on the table, to where Nebraska, their offer was like, you can't say no to this, right? Mm-hmm. And the last thing any schools want is overpaying for a player, because it's like, you won't really realize that till it's too late. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And depending on how your collective is set up, it's pretty hard to not give someone the money that they signed, or that both sides signed to agreeing to, is guaranteed, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just think that because of the lack of talent that'll be available, because the SEC conference rule, but also just because the spring window isn't nearly as active as the winter window, we're going to see a select small crop of players just have ridiculous numbers and bidding prices. And it's because, instead of 10 startable D linemen in the SEC, there will probably only be realistically one or two of them available. The guy who's seventh on that D line board of guys in the portal, who at best is a rotational player in the SEC, will be getting paid $250,000, $300,000, $350,000, $400,000, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be just because schools will need a body that bad, and they're going to reap the rewards of it. So
I apologize. I had to sneeze. I had to go off camera for a minute. I felt that one coming off for a few seconds. But it's kind of like, to Jordan's point, it's kind of like an NBA draft or an NFL draft, where a position, like let's say it's a down year for quarterback. Like, go back to the 2022 NFL draft, right? Kenny Pickett probably shouldn't have been a first round pick, but because there was a need for quarterbacks, they're going to get overdrafted. And in years where, if it matches up where there's a year where they're in short supply on top of several teams that have a need, like I guarantee you, the 2021 draft, perfect example, like we talked about it, five go in the first round. Trevor Lawrence is the only one that's still on his original team, right? Have the Jets done anything with Zach Wilson? They cut Zach Wilson or traded Zach Wilson? I don't think so.
Don't believe so. But Zach Wilson, count him.
Zach Wilson's not a part of the Jets' future. Mac Jones is already done with the Patriots. Trey Lance is done with the 49ers. He's been done with the 49ers. Justin Fields done with the Bears. All those guys are gone. So, yeah, that position, that's kind of what Jordan's talking about. You're going to see guys that there's a lot of not just the money, but the activity around them, like whoever lands those players, the fan base is going to be really excited. That, oh man, we got one of the best available players in the portal, right? But had player at X position been available in the winter window, they might have been the eighth best guy at that position.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because I mean, the transfer portal, it reflects a lot of what NFL free agency is, except it's in such a more condensed time, and there's, you know, such less regulations about it. But like, and recruiting is the same way. Like I've talked about it a lot, but the defensive backs in 2025 are kind of just suck. Like it's a really weak year for defensive backs. And like, man, at safety, Texas, it's Jonah Williams and it's Cade Phillips. Those are the two safety guys.
Yeah.
Those are the only guys that I've been able to tell they're consistently talking to. Most of the out-of-state guys, they drop from and are kind of going all in on those two. The chances they're able to sign both of them, incredibly low. Mm-hmm. But chances they're able to sign one of them, I like those chances. But like Cade Phillips and Jonah Williams, not trying to take anything away from them as players, but if you were to put these guys in the class before, I guarantee you their NIL would be lower. Like the numbers those guys are going to end up with will be higher the normal because there it's such a scarce commodity. Like a safety that's playable in the Power Five is there's not many of them this cycle. There just isn't.
Yeah.
And especially in Texas and in the South. So all these guys are about to reap the rewards of having, you know, plenty of schools but not enough DBs to go around. Whenever that happens, guys get overpaid. It's what happened with Oshawn Mathis. So
that's by the way, the Oshawn Mathis thing that I was going to bring up a second ago, and I'm sorry, Jordan, I wasn't trying to cut you off there, but you talk about the bang for your buck. Oshawn Mathis.
Didn't he have less than five sacks?
He had 48 tackles, and I'm just looking at Sports Reference, so these could be off by a few. 48 tackles, 3.5 sacks, 5 tackles for loss. You look at what Baron Sorrell gave Texas in 2022. He had 4 fewer tackles, but he had 5.5 sacks and 9 TFLs. Baron Sorrell gave Texas, a guy that was already on their roster, gave them better production than what they hypothetically would have gotten out of Oshawn Mathis.
Yep. And, you know, Oshawn Mathis is just the biggest example I can think of. But, like, man, there are so many guys like that.
You know, you mentioned safety, and I think that speaks to, first off, the first thing that Sark and company have to get figured out is there are 3 guys that got to go, right? Because you're at with Samaje Burrell's, Samaje Burrell entering the portal. You're at 88 scholarships.
Actually, they are going to get a D lineman or at least one other position out of the portal. So really, it's not 3. It's minimum 4.
Okay.
It's 3 to get down to 85. Yeah. You got to think they're going to add at least one person from the portal.
Right.
So that means 84. And like, that's only one guy, you know? So if they want to add 3, now we're looking at, they got to figure out 6 guys in the portal.
Yeah. You're in the spring window. You're at a point where guys are going to look, guys by this point, they don't need to get to the spring game and go back to last year when that, you know, right before the spring game, when you had, I think the 3, Jordan, correct me if I'm wrong, it was Jaden Alexis, Derek Brown, and Travell Johnson entered the portal like a couple days before the spring game when the portal window opened. And those three guys knew where they stood on the depth chart, right? They didn't need to get through the spring game to figure it out. There are guys already on that roster that know where they stand in terms of the depth chart. And am I going to play this year? And if I want to play, do I need to go somewhere else? There's that group of young guys, but you've also got guys that have been there 3 or 4 years that maybe they're really close to getting their degree and they just want to get through the spring semester, graduate, and then go somewhere as a grad transfer this summer. So there's a few different ways that you can do it, but I'm not worried. This staff wouldn't make moves if they didn't have an idea of where the roster was going to go, or they knew that maybe they've already been told by guys, hey coach, I want to get through spring ball to make sure I've got some stuff on tape and I'm going to hit the portal, you know, whenever the window opens. Those conversations are ongoing all the time. But you mentioned safety, Jordan, and that's a position where, to your point, where, you know, the 2025 crop of high school guys doesn't look great. If there's a guy that's got multiple years of eligibility left, and it's one of those deals where, man, you'd be stupid not to look at it. I mean, that's a situation where maybe you look at, okay, we weren't planning on taking a safety, but, man, we don't feel like it's either Cade Phillips or Jonah Williams, and maybe you feel like you don't feel like you're in a great position for either one. I don't know. We're just throwing it out there. But maybe you do take, even if it's a G5 guy, like, hey, let's just take this guy, get him in, let him cut his teeth on special teams, and then next spring – he's, you know, because Makuba's gone after this year. He's competing with, you know, whoever, Jelani McDonald, and for a spot on this team, in the starting 11.
Yeah, I mean, best case scenario would be they get a safety through the portal that signed in December, and it was just going through early enrollment and I guess spring ball, whatever school he was at. Like that, like best case scenario, obviously not going to happen. But like Texas goes and gets KJ Bolden from Georgia after he just spent 3.5 months. Like that's the best case scenario here. But yeah, no, safety is super interesting. And like, you know, while I am talking about how weak and how much depth the 2025 safety class lacks, you got to give so much credit to Texas here. Cause like, while I think, personally, I would have liked to see them maybe notice this earlier in the cycle, but like, man, they got to the fall last year and were like, oh, shit. The 25 DBs are kind of, And that's when they started making some calls to Mr. Filsimi. And they ended up getting that taken care of. But, like, man, you go and review the 2024 class they just signed. Filsimi is the only true safety. Jordan Johnson Rebell, likely a star. But to be honest with you, like, I don't know of the guys they signed, how much I'm expecting from JJR at Texas. Santana Wilson is strictly a corner. Kobe Black, you know, there's a lot of talk about how we had him as a safety and he's a corner and all that. They love him in the Ryan Watts position, that big physical corner on the boundary. Mm-hmm. But if it ever came to it, I think he could be moved to safety and he'd be pretty successful there. Wardell Mack is most likely only going to be strictly a corner at Texas, but I think he could have some versatility safety. But like,
that's the guy that I'm looking at, because guys that are high school, and look, when I say Wardell Mack was a high school quarterback, like it's not like he's back there like, you know, breaking out coverages and just throwing piss missiles. But you know, and I don't, it's no disrespect to Wardell Mack, it's just, hey, best athlete on the team, let's just put him at quarterback and let's go. But guys typically that are high school quarterbacks that see it from that position, that make that flip to safety, those guys usually tend to work out, you know, if the ball skills and the physical skills are there. I don't think there's any question about that with Wardell Mack. You know, I think about a guy like Adrian Phillips was one of those guys that played so many different spots in high school, Jordan, that you're like, all right, he's a jack of all trades, but is he a master of none? Like, I really don't know where. You didn't get a good enough view of him at any of those positions, kind of like Wardell Mack, to really figure out where he best fits. But, you know, and this would be a compliment if Wardell Mack is one of those guys, but Dwayne Aquino always said about Adrian Phillips, the only guy he ever coached that could legitimately play every position in the secondary. Could play field corner, boundary corner, field safety, boundary safety, nickel, and even if you wanted him to play in your dime package, he could do that too. Like, just a guy that cerebrally understood the game incredibly well. I don't know if Wardell Mack is on that level, but there's, like I said, of all the great players, Dwayne Aquino coached at Texas, Phillips was the only one. But Wardell Mack is a guy that I think if you looked at him at safety, just because of the high school quarterback background, does he see it in a different way that makes that transition easier? Warren Roberson's another guy that, man, if you just want to get him on the field, maybe safety's a place to do it. But you've got options, and I do like the fact that Sark has mentioned they've made more of an effort this spring to cross-train guys at both positions than maybe they have before.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be important because you'd love to have Jonah Williams in this class, but, man, his recruitment is just so open and so all over the place that there's just so much that's going to go on over the next few months.
The baseball thing, too, we talk about with him is a legit deal.
Yeah, so like with him, I mean, we're so far from it getting to nut cutting time and crunch time and his recruitment. And you know, Cade Phillips is really talented. He's a 4-star, but I mean, Jonah Williams is like, in all honesty, one of the best athletes I've ever seen. Not just athlete position in football, but like the sports athlete is up there with the best I've ever seen. He's a special prospect. There's a reason he has the ranking he has, and there's a reason he's the number one target at the safety position for every school in the South. So that being said, they'd love to have him, but this is how I looked at it. Colin Simmons last year was a need. They needed an edge. They needed a game-changing pass rusher on this roster. Now they have one.
Mm-hmm.
Jonah Williams is an elite athlete. Is an elite safety prospect. I feel very confident that if football ends up being what he chooses to do, he will play in the NFL one day and get drafted in the NFL one day.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't classify Jonah Williams as technically a need. I think he'd be really nice, but he isn't a need. There are few true needs on this team now after 3 years of Sark and his staff being here, the way they've constructed the team.
Yeah.
But with Jonah Williams, like I talked about, there's not a ton of top-tier safeties walking around. So, you know, Texas is going to have to get super, super aggressive if they want to win that one. And, you know, they don't need a game-changing safety this year. I don't think they'll necessarily need one next year. But, like, if you want to be the Georgia, if you want to be the Alabama, if you want to be a program like that, you need to stack the top players every single year.
Right, no question.
And have depth. And, like, the depth, I think, is going to become, it's talked about, but in the grand scheme of college football, the main things you hear are NIL and the portal. I think depth is going to become much more important to just the national conversation. Once people realize with the 12-team playoff, you got to play, what, 16, 17? How many games you got to play?
Oh, you
know?
Man.
So that's something that hasn't been thought of, you know, to where you got to think, man, we're playing 16 games or 17 if they make it to the Natty. Very, very low chances you're not going to have to rely on your third, fourth, fifth string guy at some point throughout the season. Just because injuries, that's the way the ball rolls. So, that you got to keep stacking depth. And again, while Jonah Williams probably even if let's say Texas signs him, probably not going to play a ton as a freshman just because you won't really be relied to or needed to. Mm-hmm. But the year after that, 26, obviously that's when it's important. But, like, look at what Texas has already on the roster. Those guys will be in their third and fourth year then. So,
yeah. You also got to look at it too, Jordan. You know, do some guys, like, let's stay on the safety topic, right? Take a guy like Derek Williams. Let's say Derek Williams is in a position, his draft eligible year after the 25 season. Let's say he's in a position to make an NFL decision. Well, if the decision is, do I go and be a third round pick, or am I making enough NIL money to where, no, I want to boost my stock to see if I can be in a first or second round pick and come back to school for another year? Because we know, and I mentioned safety, because we know that's a position that the league doesn't value that much when it comes to the draft. So you got those kind of decisions too. I think not to just beat the safety topic into the ground, but you know, you look at your 25 depth chart, it's a nice situation to be in when, like, your worst case scenario. I think this is your worst case scenario for depth, that you convince Michael Taft to come back for that one more year that he's got.
Yeah, and I mean, you brought up the NIL. Like, Texas has plenty of money, but, like, I'm very confident in saying at least once a year Texas will be able to, like, do what they did with Jalen Ford last year. He had, what, a fourth, fifth round grade?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, that chump change. Like, that Texas can get any guy with the third, fourth, fifth round grade to come back. They can't afford that. So, with that being said, they're not going to do that with every single guy that has a third, fourth, and fifth round grade. But, like, for example, you brought up Derek Williams. They can make that happen very easily.
Yeah.
Like, that's literally what they did with Drew Makuba, except he came from another program. He wasn't already at Texas.
Yeah.
So, if that's the situation, it'll be, like, I'm pretty comfortable with Texas figuring it out just because, again, they're always going to have the funds and structure to be able to make that happen, to have a guy come back for another year. So, yeah, but, I mean, again, you always want to stack talent. And with safety, it's important. So,
Has Bill Norton from Arizona, I wasn't paying attention this weekend, has he officially gone into the portal? Like, is he officially in the portal?
So I don't believe so. I haven't seen Hummer or any of our guys post he's officially in there. At the same time, I know the portal doesn't open till tomorrow, but on the same note, I believe Norton's a grad transfer, so I don't think it would
matter. He's a grad transfer. I just didn't know if his name had popped yet or not.
So. Yeah. As far as this goes with Hank Harris from San Marcos, really interesting prospect because I don't know how much anyone remembers it, but San Marcos got popped by the UIL a while back.
Mm-hmm.
Hank Harris was included in that. So he hasn't – like, if that kid wasn't wrapped up in that investigation, he would have started and been San Marcos' number one receiver on varsity the last 2 years in a row.
Where was he at before San Marcos?
So he showed up to San Marcos as a freshman, first day of school. But the reason –
Where would he have gone?
Couldn't tell you. Okay. I don't know. I've talked to Hank a lot, but I've actually never asked him that. But what happened was the reason San Marcos got swatted was because there's a – I'm not going to name them, but there's a 7-on-7 program in the San Antonio area, and one of their coaches was hired by San Marcos. And then the first day of school that fall, there were like 12 of the 18 players from the 7-on-7 program just showed up at San Marcos. And none of them went to the San Marcos middle school. Middle schools. You know how it works in recruiting in certain areas, like a wave of talent will come through. There's a wave of talent in San Antonio in 2026 and 2027. And like of like those other kids that were with Hank, there's like three other kids who I look at and think they're Power Five or at least G5. Mm-hmm. No, that San Marcos doesn't get a ton of those. So like there are red flags instantly and UIL caught them. And also, if you know who the San Marcos head coach is, has some baggage with him. And I think the UIL was kind of wanting to get his ass a little bit as well. And so they really brought down the hammer. But with all that being said, Hank Harris hasn't played a varsity snap yet in his high school career. And again, if the UIL thing was never a thing, he would have been San Marcos' number one wideout the last 2 years. So
yeah,
I love Hank Harris. I like him as a prospect. He's been great every time I've seen him in 7-on-7. But like, man, you're only going to get so many offers off of camp and in-person evals. You're going to have varsity film. And so I think a lot of schools are waiting on that for him as a junior. Do I view him as someone who could potentially be a Texas talent? Yes. But looking at him right now, I don't really view him as a talent like the Chris Stewarts or the Keyshawn Hendersons, where those guys are 2026 receiver prospects where you look at him and they're like, yes, that will be a Texas guy. Where Hank Harris is more so of that could be a Texas guy. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah,
that's kind of how I view.
I might have to get over there this spring because San Marcos High is literally like 10 minutes down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. So he doesn't have a Texas offer yet. He's mostly just got like, I think UTSA, Baylor, TCU, local stuff like that. But like in terms of the big time offers he's deserving of, he's not going to be able to post those or get those until he gets a junior film. And with varsity tape. So yeah, that's, I guess, kind of Hank Harris. So, you know, he's a local kid. He's 6'3", 180. He's obviously very talented. I assume Texas is just going to keep him warm and keep him visiting till they feel he's worthy of an offer. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. CBS in the chat, who was the last great five-tool DB to play at Texas? I mean, probably Kenny Vaccaro, right?
I think Drew Macuba could be the next one because, you know, he can play corner. I doubt they're going to use him at corner next year, though. I know he's going to play some nickel, but he's primarily going to be a safety. But if it ever came to it, like, I'd feel pretty good about Drew Macuba being out on the boundary or vice versa.
It could have and probably should have been Brandon Jones. You know, he, dude, I'm telling you, man, if some people knew some of the injuries that some of those guys in the Tom Herman era played with, or that were based on what I was told from people close to some of those guys, what some of those guys were strongly encouraged to play through by certain members of the regime, it would floor you. And I think it sucks because I think it, Brandon Jones, and I think Brandon Jones has shown in the league that he's still a damn good football player. Same thing for Caden Stearns. Those guys should have been drafted higher than they were. You know, BJ Foster should be in the NFL right now. But again, some of that was his own doing, and some of that was, man, some people knew the stuff he played through. It's, you'd wonder how. Yeah, there's a reason why BJ Foster didn't look like himself in 2019. Like, the 2018 version of BJ Foster and the 2019 version were two very different things. So yeah, it's unfortunate. But yeah, I think Brandon Jones could have been that guy. I think Caden Stearns should have been that guy. There's been a few that have come through Texas that probably could have been a five-tool DB since Kenny Vaccaro.
Yeah, I mean, I remember Caden Stearns his freshman year just being like, damn, Texas has this guy two more years. Like, it's about time they got some NFL talent.
Yeah.
And then it went like that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And it's a combination, you know, the kind of the tape that gets unfairly put on his highlight reel for the bad stuff is the 3rd and 17 against LSU. Well, I mean, you basically, based on his physical health at the time, I mean, Caden Stearns was a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest.
And versus the asking to cover one and number two receiver in the NFL.
Yeah. It was a bad deal all the way around.
Yeah.
But no, man, you know, Texas, like I said, Texas had some, man, that just got me thinking, man, Brandon Jones had a really good career at Texas. Don't get me wrong, but should have been drafted higher than he was.
Yeah. Yep.
And by the way, if anybody wants to speculate who I'm talking about, I'm not talking about Craig Nyver making those guys play through injuries. Craig Nyver's good people.
Yeah, Todd Orlando had everyone jumping great off the dude. Diving board.
Yeah, it's, man, that is one of the great mysteries. It's unfortunate how you had that run of Texas defensive coordinators, right, with Manny Diaz, Vance Bedford, and then Todd Orlando, where they kind of reaped the benefits of the struggles that the guy before them had. You know, you look at Will Muschamp's 2010 defense, they lost a lot from 09, but the guts of that defense, too, you still had a crap ton of NFL players. Keenan Robinson, Manuel Acho, Keyston Randall, Sam Acho didn't come back for 11. Alex Okafor, like, you had several guys on that 2010 defense that ended up playing in the league. That's why the 2011 defense was one of the best in the country. And then that wave of guys fell off. You had to rebuild. Diaz gets fired. Vance Bedford comes in, and it's like, wow, you got Malcolm Brown and Jordan Hicks and Quandre Diggs, Cedric Reed. You got some NFL, Mikel Thompson. You got a lot of NFL guys. And then those guys move on. He gets fired. Todd Orlando gets the job. Wow, it's Malik Jefferson and Holton Hill and Chris Boyd and all these guys that were playing as freshmen. And then those guys move out, and then, you know, turns out the cupboard wasn't that full for PK. But PK's done the exact opposite. It's bizarro, those guys, where he got the bad year out of the way first, and through recruiting they've built it up. And now, you know, I'm not expecting Texas to have a top 10 run defense in the country in 2024, but – you know, Jordan, I don't see that thing going back into the 80s either.
Yeah. And I mean, it's funny bringing up all those guys that the different DCs inherited. Like, Yeah, I don't know. Just like, hey, here's our misfit toys that don't work together. Mm-hmm. We're going to pay you to make them work together. Yeah. And whenever they don't work because they're not going to work, the whole fan base will turn on you and blame it on you. You sign here.
Yeah. Because like, at that point, yeah. You know, Manny Diaz, like, let's take Manny Diaz, right? Made it work in 2011 with dudes that were even a young Quandre Diggs. You had Blake Gideon still. Like, you had guys that had played for Will Muschamp and knew what quality defense was all about. But the second year, 2012, okay, now you're taking guys that were recruited to play for Will Muschamp. To your point, now you've got to make them fit into your defensive philosophy. Dude, Manny Diaz's defensive philosophy and Will Muschamp's are totally different. You know, Will Muschamp's is controlled chaos. It's disciplined. It's from that Nick Saban, Kirby Smart school of defense. Whereas Manny Diaz, it's just chaos, right? Like, they talk about dropping guys out of helicopters and doing all these exotics. Well, if you're doing that with inexperienced dudes that don't know what they're doing, yeah, you get a product that it's all it is forget the org. There is no organized part. It's just chaos. And that's what we saw in 2012. And then in 2013, to an extent, Greg Robinson thought did a hell of a job. The late, great Greg Robinson did a hell of a job with that 2013 defense. But those guys took their lumps. And what should have been their junior and senior years playing for Manny Diaz, by the time you got the kinks worked out, now they're playing for Vance Bedford and Charlie Strong.
Mm.
And so on and so forth. So now I think this is the first time, as CB mentioned in the chat, PK is the longest tenured defensive coordinator Texas has had since Bull Reese. I think the fact that you've got guys now, Jordan, that they've come into the program, they're in the same system for multiple years. The older guys in front of them can help them understand what to do. You know, other than a few separate positions like linebacker and defensive tackle, you've had the same position coaches. So there's some familiarity, but there's no complacency, right? Things aren't stale. It's still new enough at Texas to where things aren't stale. And I feel like we talked a lot about the secondary on the show today, but I hope they're not stale in that secondary room, because we've talked about it, man. It fair or not, it's a referendum year on Blake Gideon and Terry Joseph, because if you're Sark and PK, you've fixed all other areas of the defense, right? Whether it's been through personnel or scheme, now there's no excuse for the secondary not improving, because you've made personnel adjustments, your scheme adjustments. Everybody should understand how you're playing match quarters now. You should be able to be scheme versatile. Like, there's no excuse for the secondary to just look like they're lost at times. It's college football. Everybody's got good skill position players. Guys are going to get burned. Guys are going to give up big plays. But those stretches like we saw against TCU, against U of H, where you just got like that quarter and a half of football where the opposing offense is just moving the ball up and down the field at will, that's the stuff that's got to stop. Like, what happened in the Washington game? Yeah, Michael Penix played the game of his life. But, man, you can't have receivers running scot-free, and you can't be losing that many one-on-one battles. It just can't happen. You're going to lose some, but you can't lose the overwhelming majority.
Yeah. No, you can't. And just real quick before we forget, can you talk about this?
I'll never forget the dust there. Major gave Chip after Chip asked Mac. Okay. Put that up again. The dust there, Major Applewhite gave Chip after Chip asked Mac about Manny Diaz following the debacle in Provo. I'll be honest, CB, I don't know if you'd have to ask Chip about that, because I wasn't in Provo. I didn't go to that game. I always say, when Rod was doing sidelines, Rod would never text me during the game. He might text like one thing at halftime if he got a break. But I was getting some hot sports opinions that night from my man Rod Babers, and I think if you're an alum that played defense at Texas, every Texas defense, like, everybody has bad games, but that was
a bad season.
to give up, you know, whatever they gave, was it 550 rushing yards or what? Like, dude, that was just that was unacceptable. I think it was 550 total, 259 on the ground, whatever it was.
Taysom Mormon missile dude, taking him to the woodshed.
It was as bad of a defensive performance as you'll ever see in your life. Like, it was brutal. And okay, yeah, CB, I wasn't there, so you'd have to ask Chip about that. And that's one that I don't care to pull up the press conference from that BYU game and go look at it. But yeah, it's if you were a Texas defensive player at any point and you watched that BYU game, you were disgusted, you were pissed off, you were embarrassed. It was as bad could be. And you know what, though, Jordan, the sad thing is, there were good players on that defense. That defense was so much better than that. Like Adrian Phillips, Quandre Diggs, Jackson Jeffcoat, Malcolm Brown, Hassan Ridgeway. Like, you had dudes that played in the league, and dudes that went on to be first round picks, high draft picks, Pro Bowls, all Pro Bowl guys, all pros. And that defense just could not stop a nosebleed, man.
Shit, nobody could stop the Mormon missile, baby. Come on. People in the NFL still can't even stop the Mormon missile.
Hey, man, the only thing that slowed down Taysom Hill in college were his injuries.
Well, yeah, you're going to get injured when you're like 28 playing a bunch of 18-year-olds.
Oh, man. So CB says that's not on YouTube. Yeah, man, it's that 13th season, though, not to it's hard to believe that's been 11 years. But, man, the one thing I'll never forget about that season is the job Greg Robinson did. It's almost like, I don't know, Jordan, you're probably too young to remember, but that was Texas had those back-to-back just awful losses to OU in 11 and 12. 11 was a 55-17, and 2012 was 63-21. 63-21 was the one where Matt called a timeout with like 9 seconds left, try to set up a touchdown. And I was in the college. It was the first Texas OU game I covered from the press box. And all my OU buddies are texting me, and even my disgusted Texas friends are texting me, telling me to go back and watch the TV copy, because the TV copy, when Matt called the timeout with 9 seconds left, down 63-13, the camera caught, or whatever it was, this camera caught Bob Stoops laughing, like, that Matt called a timeout. And like, they were like, this is absolute rock bottom. If they only knew what was coming with those Kansas games a few years later. But anyway, it was like the whole offseason revolved around winning the OU game. So it was almost like Greg Robinson, in the quest to fix the defense, it's almost like, look, I don't care what happens the first week against Ole Miss. And then you got K-State conference opener, and then Iowa State. We're going to be ready for Oklahoma. And, man, the zone blitzes that they brought out for that Oklahoma game, that was the one where Chris Whaley drops into coverage and gets that pick six. And I think they sacked Blake Bell like, I don't know, 7-8 times that day, forcing turnovers. Like, it was to see what that thing was in Provo and to see what it was like in the Cotton Bowl. It's like, dude, it's an entirely different defense. It's a complete 180.
Yeah, that was that's one of my favorite Texas OU memories. You know, Chris Whaley just running over the belldozer on the goal line and extending the ball. It was fucking awesome. Not a Blake Bell fan at all. So when the 49ers turned him into a tight end, I was like, I would much rather this roster spot go to, like, quite literally anyone else. But, yeah, that's one of my favorite Texas OU memories of all time. And if I'm not mistaken, that was one of the years Texas had, like, all the gold trimming or whatever you want to call it.
They were supposed to do it for a couple years in a row, but
I didn't mind it. I thought it looked cool. I understand why people would think it looks tacky. I think it looked dope. I also do think that, like, that style of I don't know if style uniform, but like those type of accents with the gold and all that, like, that was popping back 10 years ago.
Even the
nowadays, it's not as popular.
Either. No, even the OU stuff, because remember, both sides had gold cleats. The swoosh logo was gold. The piping on the uniforms was gold. And I saw the following year, or maybe it was 2 years later, I don't remember, I passed Cedric Reed's family going into the Cotton Bowl, and I hadn't thought about those jerseys in a minute. And I see Cedric's dad and his little brother, and his little brother's wearing Cedric's jersey from that game. And I'm like, I forgot how clean those jerseys look. Those were nice.
Yeah. Damn, wearing a game jersey would be pretty. That's a flex.
I think it was supposed to, it was a deal where, and I don't know if it was a deal where Charlie discontinued it or they just lost, both sides lost interest, but they both sides had the gold accents for the 13 game. And I think it was supposed to be from then on, whoever won the game the following year, since they got the golden hat, the winning team would get the gold accents for the following year's game.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I would have no problem with that coming back.
I dig it, man. I don't know, man. That might be might have to blob that question to somebody in the equipment, on the equipment side at UT, why Nike hasn't done that. So,
yeah. I don't know. I can't wait for if that ever ends up coming back. People are just going to be like, well, they can change the uniforms, but they can't kick this game off at 7. Like, dude, no. The game needs to be an 11 a.m. kick. The very latest, 2:30. Not a good part of town. You don't want folks from both sides drinking all damn day at the fair.
There's something.
And they play at 7. Like, there couldn't be a worse combo of different things than a 7 o'clock Texas OU. Like, seriously, it can't get worse than a 7 o'clock Texas OU.
There is something poetic about seeing a bunch of hungover ass people walking onto the fairgrounds looking like, dude, I need to, you know, when you're hangover so bad, you just need to start drinking is the only thing that'll cure it. Like seeing a bunch of hungover people like, dude, I need a corn dog or a turkey leg or something. Like I gotta get some food in me. I need something fried, something greasy to push out last night's mess so I can start drinking again before this game. There's just something, I don't know, man. It's like, something, the 11 a.m. kickoff for that game fits. I don't really dig 11 a.m. kickoffs. They're okay. Now that I'm old and I have a daughter, since I'm up early anyway, the 11 a.m. kick doesn't bother me as much as it did 10 years ago. But for that game, man, the 11 a.m. kick works. Because I like it because the 11 a.m. kick, whoever wins, like that fan base basically takes over. They take over the fair. They take over Dallas. Like, you go out on
the rest of the day. Yeah. If the game's ending at 11, are the Texas or OU fans going to go take over Fair Park at 11 or 12 at night on a Saturday? Fuck no. They're getting in their cars and going home because they're scared of what might happen.
If you're a Texas fan, like even me, like covering Texas, there's something cool about leaving the press box, making the walk back to my car, and seeing nothing but burnt orange on the midway. Right. Maybe you see a few OU fans here and there, but dude, it is all burnt orange at that point. Like Texas fans are just enjoying the hell out of themselves. And the opposite, man, like it reinforces for you when the years when Oklahoma wins, it reinforces for you like, damn, can't believe they lost that game, or I can't wait to get out of some. A couple years it's been, well, I can't wait to get out of here. Some years it's been, I can't believe they lost that game.
Yeah.
Last year was one of those.
Yeah, hey, people watching, if you want to comment your favorite Texas OU memory / game or just memory and why, feel free to. I'd actually be really interested to see some of the responses. For me, it'll have to, the only time I've seen it in person was the 2022 49-0 game. So, you know, that'll take the cake. But, you know, I'm hoping I can be back this year and actually on the field. I remember that 49-0 game, just walking into the stadium, I'm like, there's no way this is how this game is supposed to feel. Like, I don't know if you felt it. That was my first ever time in the Cotton Bowl, but I was like, this is not what I assumed it would look like on TV, and there's no way it's just like this, because, like, in warmups, it's almost like you could feel it from the Oklahoma side. They knew they were about to get their ass beat. Like, in warmups, you could just look at the difference in the way Texas is warming up, their energy, compared to OU. OU had no energy. It's like they're getting ready for a slaughter, because, I mean, that's what happened.
That's a game where you can tell if the energy is fake, if you're trying to convince yourself. Now, like, I think you or it's just confidence, it's bored, it spills into cockiness, which, like, the 2019 game for Texas, that's what it was. Like, this last year's game, I felt like Texas was confident. That game could have gotten away from Oklahoma, because you could tell, like, Oklahoma wasn't, they weren't downtrodden like they were the year before, or just, you know, realizing what the inevitable is going to be, but they needed something to go kind of like Texas in 13. Oklahoma needed something to go right for them early in that game, and getting that interception when they did, and the way that Oklahoma sideline erupted, you could tell that was the moment where they're like, okay, we're fine. We're in this. We can play with Texas. And yeah, you know, that's what it was. But yeah, 49-0. Like, you could tell, like, Oklahoma had some of that false bravado, almost trying to convince themselves, like, yeah, we can play. And the Texas guys, it was that scary kind of quiet confidence of, we're not going to say anything. We're not going to do anything. We're just going to line up and kick your ass, and you're gonna like it for the next 3 hours.
Yeah, and, like, the thing that was so crazy about the 49-0 game, too, is, like, everyone in the stadium kind of sensed that Texas was, you know, going to be the victor. But, like, after that first OU series, when the whole stadium realized they weren't going to be able to move the ball, like, I mean, like many people who were watching this, I assume y'all were on the same side as me, the Texas side of the stadium. And, like, I just remembered kind of looking around and seeing everybody realize, like, this is not going to be close. And yeah, it was like less than a minute into the game.
When it was early on, you realize, okay, this is going to be a Texas win. How bad is it going to be? And then when Jadae picked off that jump pass that they tried to run, at that point, I'm like, all right, it's going to be really freaking bad. It's basically going to be whatever Sark decides it wants to be. It was whatever he decides he wants it to be.
Yeah, I remember after the Jadae pick, I turned to my buddy who's there, and he's like, well, you might just start calling them the 49ers, because that might be the only time they cross the 50 today. And I think it was like one of the two times they crossed the 50 that day. It was something wild, but and like that game was fun because like it was just such an ass whooping, but also like you could just tell kind of towards once we got into halftime, all the Texas fans were like, all right, we kind of want to speed this up so we can go out to the fair. Cause you know, everyone's waiting for the eyes of Texas at the end, but like, yeah. And like, what? I don't know, like I told my dad this whenever I got back that weekend from that game, but like, man, like that was truly a bucket list game and bucket list activity for me. And like, you know, you always want a Texas dub, and I guess for my first time, my first experience in the Cotton Bowl, I wished it would have been more of a competitive, energy filled game. My dad was like, hell no, take that. You got to take that. Like, yeah,
no, dude.
I was like, I understand, but I wish it would have just kind of been like, you know, one of the classics we talk about. Cause no, like,
I've got I was a junior in high school when the 63-14 game happened, the year OU won the national championship. That game traumatized me for this rivalry. And, '01, there's been a couple of games that Oklahoma's won, 2001 was one of them. There's been a couple of those. Last year's, I thought too, was one of these that you just appreciate it because it's two good football teams that just knock the hell out of each other for 60 minutes. Like, you really appreciate what that game is about. But man, I've watched some of them. I've watched some of those Texas blowout losses on TV. I've watched one in person. And what I just talked about, what you talked about Oklahoma in the 22 game, that's what I felt like for Texas, like covering the 2012 game. I don't know if you remember this, but early in that game, Texas was kind of in it. They had given up a touchdown, and Quandre had run a blocked PAT back for two. So it's like 6-2. Texas gets a punt. They pin OU back. And I realized, I was like, dude, something bad's about to happen. I think OU might get a big play right here. And that was the Damian Williams 96-yard touchdown run. And I just felt like, oh, man, it's bad. I knew I called the safety. Joe Bergeron got tackled for a safety. I called that before it was going to happen. And, man, it just – you felt like the 2003 game, the 65-13 game, that was one that I talked about. Like, had Texas gotten a big turnover last year and OU realized pretty quick, oh, man, here we go again. Texas could have won that game going away. That's how OU won the game in 03. Even though Vince Young ran for 100 yards and went crazy, Texas turned the ball over, I think, 6-7 times. And, like, Chance Mock throws an interception to Derek straight, like, on the second play of the game. And that was the moment where I was like, oh, shit, this is going to be a long day. And like five turnovers later. It was a really long day, but that game, I'm glad that game is a part of the SEC now, because the year where I just kind of lost faith, BK, I don't know if you were like this, the year the Big 12 television partners put that game on FS1, I'm like, this is your marquee game. And granted, Texas, and that was the Joe Tessitore Notre Dame year. And I think OU had lost a game or two by that point. But I was like, this is your marquee game, and it's on freaking FS1, like a channel that people have to look on their program guide to figure out, do I get that? Like, it was embarrassing. That would be like if the SEC television partners, even though, say what you want about the game, if they put like Florida and Tennessee on ESPNU.
Yeah.
Tennessee, Florida's on CBS. Like, CBS carried that game. Good, yeah, bad, or indifferent, they're going to carry that game. It was embarrassing.
They get Georgia, yeah, and Florida every year, even though like that game is turned about as one-sided as possible. Like, that game, yeah, is always a 2:30 CBS affair, and it should be. Like, that's the way it should be. The best rivalries in this sport, Jordan, should always get promoted.
Yeah, and last thing. Peyton Kirkland in the portal. By the way, if you want to remember his recruitment, he dropped the top five without Texas in it and then committed to Texas without ever visiting. Yeah, and was a freshman this past fall. Not sure if he played a snap.
He had a knee injury, actually. Remember? He had the knee.
That's right.
He saw him on crutches at the bowl game. And so we talked about it with his offensive line. At some point, some of those guys are going to realize, you know what? If I want to play, I might have to do it somewhere else other than Texas, because there's too many guys in front of you. And you look at, you know you're losing Kelvin Banks and Jake Majors after this year. Maybe, Hayden Connor won't be back. You're losing DJ Campbell, and, maybe DJ Campbell, maybe Cam Williams. But going out to practice, and BK, you'll get to see some of these guys on Saturday. Jordan, I know you didn't watch the O-line the day you were out there. But, man, you start looking at, like, Trevor Goosby and Jaden Chatman and some of these young guys, like, even, like, Daniel Cruz at center. Like, you start looking at some of these young cats, and it's like, dude, Kyle Flood's already preparing, like, that next wave of guys to be ready to take over. And if you can't crack that too deep, man, I'm not saying it's impossible, but you got one hell of an uphill battle. And like we talked about, man, guys don't need to wait until after the spring game to figure out where they are on the depth chart. They know already. They know where they are and what kind of battle it would be to have to put themselves back in a position to play.
Hey, congrats to Peyton Kirkland. Just got himself a week off, right? I mean, if he stuck it out through the end of spring practice, then he would have had to, practice a few more times and then be a part of the game on Saturday. Now he gets the week off and he gets to figure out where he's headed next. Good for him.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those deals where he's young enough. Jordan, I know we talked about this too, guys that maybe wait too long and it's like, okay, you're in that limbo where you don't have enough game film to give people an idea of what you can do, but you're too far removed from being a high school prospect that people just aren't going to take a flyer on you. There will be a power conference program that takes a flyer on Peyton Kirkland. He's young enough to where one of those schools that was interested in him that needs offensive linemen, they'll be there for him.
Yeah. Man, with Peyton Kirkland, I'm not trying to kick the horse while it's down, but like, I am not surprised at all by this. There are so many red flags when you drop a top five without the school you're committing to in it, and then you commit to that school without ever visiting. Like, right there, but also, like, I remember the All-American Bowl check-in. He showed up. Y'all want to guess how much this kid weighed when he showed up? Because we did not report the actual number.
370.
BK, you want to take a guess?
Say 385.
396.
Oh!
He showed up in San Antonio at 396 the week before he moved into Texas.
Yeah.
And All of us then kind of already knew that he probably wasn't going to work out in Texas. But once that happened, it was like, whoa.
Yeah, and then he had the knee injury, and it was really just out of sight, out of mind at that point.
Yeah, but like in that at All-American, he didn't even play or practice. He wasn't hurt.
Oh, my God.
You know, well, so. You know,
there's a lot of good food in San Antonio. He was trying to be like the women Charles Barkley always talks about, I guess.
Yeah, but like with guys like that, like, at you know, whenever stuff like that happens, we're never going to go run and report, hey, y'all, this is why we don't think Peyton Kirkland will ever work out here. But like, jeez, it's definitely thoughts that go through our head. And there's guys like this in every class Texas signs. But, you know, we're never going to come out and expose these kids. But like, I'd be lying to you if I wasn't expecting this at some point in time during Peyton Kirkland's career at Texas. And also, it's just like, man, look around. Look at what they signed the same year as him and the other guys that they signed last year. Like, you look at Brandon Baker, you look at Peyton Kirkland. Visually, which one do you think looks better and is the better prospect? And then you go look at the guys that came in at the same time as Peyton Kirkland in his class. Like, Jaden Chapman seems miles ahead of where he was. I know he got an injury, so it's kind of unfair. But, like, Goosby, too, they just seem so much further ahead than Kirkland, where it's like, man, going through this roster the last few weeks and trying to figure out which guys are going to be the ones that go in the portal because there are four of them. He was on my list. Being like, he makes a lot of sense. So not surprised to see him kind of getting ahead of the curve by going in today when it opens tomorrow. You know, smart thing to do. And I wouldn't be surprised to see some other names from Texas announced today as well. Yeah. So
like I said,
with that being said, I got to start working on some of those stories.
Yeah, go ahead, Jordan.
Because I was kind of thinking Peyton would probably wait till tomorrow or the day after, maybe after the spring game to announce. But like, this tells me I got to speed up my work a little bit. So
I'm gonna say this while you can't defend yourself, because I know you're leaving, Jordan. But the Texas OU game needs to be played at night, and that's all I will say. If you want to cement yourself as the best rivalry in sports, you need casualties. And we will get casualties if you play Texas OU at night in Fair Park. So that's what I just care about the game. I care about the rivalry. So that's what I'm looking for. But, you know, not everyone is my level of fan, I suppose.
I guess, I don't know. I'll be with you then, BK, at night in Fair Park, because it's like, hey, if we're in a bad part of town, I think I'm a little more threatening than –
no way,
Mr. Kellner. So
I'm shoving you down and running. You are stuck.
It's not even, I can't tell you what parts of the Fair Park area are gentrified at this point. It's not the area that concerns me. It's the gross amount of alcohol consumption throughout the entire day.
And the amount of people packed into one small space.
Because you gotta think, like, it's not just the 92,500 in the Cotton Bowl. There's probably another 40,000 on the fairgrounds or whatever it is. But you're probably talking like 150,000 to 200,000 people drunk off their asses, probably the majority of them.
The scientific term. Can you just imagine? They're like, we're cutting to Gus Johnson. He's at the Cotton Bowl. And he's like, yeah, I'm outside at the chicken toss with a few people drunk off their asses. I'm like, how have y'all's day been?
You know, you're telling me you don't want that? You don't want Gus Johnson commentating fair games?
Oh, we got, that'd be awesome. We got like Lee Corso turn around at game day. Like, you're drunk off your ass. I'd love to see it.
That English was way too good if you're doing a Lee Corso impersonation. So
no, it was horrible. Horrible. This is also another thing. Like, you got to drive home if it's a 7 o'clock kick. They're going to kick people out of the park by midnight. So like, yeah, not everyone is taking the DART train. So
You're right. Yeah. No, nobody drunk drives home from the Cotton Bowl right now. That's for sure. Never seen that happen.
You know what I meant.
I know.
Well,
it's never gonna happen. You're right. You're a good person. I want people to die. So clearly my argument is not gonna carry much weight with people, but whatever.
Yeah. Hey, I will say, this is the last thing I'll say before I get out of here. I've probably driven from Dallas to Austin in the last 3 years over 100 times, like legitimately probably over 100 times. The fastest I have ever gotten from Dallas to my house in Austin was the 49-0 game. As soon as the game ended, me and my buddies, we didn't go to the park. We just went to my car and drove home. And I'm dead ass serious. For probably two-thirds of that drive, I was going like over 90, 92, 95. And it wasn't me just hauling ass. It was me going the flow of traffic because everyone was driving that fast going home. So I guess when Texas wins big, that's how you get home quick.
What? How long did it take you?
I don't remember, but it was by far the fastest because I was like in the 90s the whole time.
Well, you got to remember, like, you stayed through the eyes of Texas. Like, the there was a lot of OU fans that beat the traffic that day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's true.
Well, I'll get out of here. I'll see y'all tomorrow. Y'all have a good show.
All right, Jordan.
Take care.
Appreciate you, dude.
Yes, sir.